Jaya Ranjabi Hari Gopi Jana Balaba Kirivaradari Gopi Jana Balaba Kirivaradari Jasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tiravana Chari Yamuna Tiravana Chari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari Gopi Jana Balava Kirivaradari Gopi Jana Balava Kirivaradari Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tiravana Chari Yamuna Tiravana Chari Jaya Vishnu Pada Paramahamsa Parabraja Gacharya Asatara Satishi Shimada Sivana Grace Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Charya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shri Kaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopinath Shri Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai, Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamai Juna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Pramananda. All glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nivasesis and Nivani Paskatyade Satarani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Manchakalpa Chupischa, keep us in the Vieva Top, teach an Pavanavia, Vaishnava Namon Maha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
It's December 25th, 2017, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 28, Kapila's Instructions on the Execution of Devotional Service, Text 3. Gramya Dharma Navritischa.
Gramya Dharma Navritischa.
Moksha Dharma Ratistata.
Moksha Dharma Ratistata.
Mita Meda Danam Shashvad.
Mita Meda Danam Shashvad.
Vivikta Kshema Sevanam.
Vivikta Kshema Sevanam.
Gramya.
Gramya.
Conventional.
Conventional.
Dharma.
Dharma.
Religious practice.
Religious practice.
Nivritti.
Nivritti.
Ceasing.
Ceasing.
Cha.
Cha.
And.
And.
Moksha.
Moksha.
For salvation.
For salvation. For salvation.
Dharma.
Dharma.
Religious practice.
Religious practice.
Ratihi.
Ratihi.
Being attracted to.
Being attracted to.
Tata.
Tata.
In that way.
In that way.
Mitta.
Mitta.
Little.
Little. Little.
Medya.
Medya.
Pure.
Pure.
Adhanam.
Adhanam.
Eating.
Eating.
Shashvat.
Shashvat.
Always.
Always. Always.
Vivikta.
Vivikta.
Secluded.
Secluded.
Shema.
Shema.
Peaceful.
Peaceful. Peaceful.
Sevanam.
Sevanam.
Dwelling.
Dwelling.
Muted.
Just a moment. What?
Unmuted.
Yes, now I've unmuted.
One second, I just lost it. One moment, just somehow lost the verse, like completely.
A
translation in purport. One should cease performing conventional religious practices and should be attracted to those which lead to salvation. One should eat very frugally and should always remain secluded so that he can achieve the highest perfection of life. Srila Prabhupada's purport. It is recommended herein that religious practice for economic development or the satisfaction of sense desires should be avoided. Religious practices should be executed only to gain freedom from the clutches of material nature. It is stated in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam that the topmost religious practice is that by which one can attain to the transcendental devotional service of the Lord without reason or cause. Such religious practice is never hampered by any impediments, and by its performance one actually becomes satisfied. Here this is recommended as moksha dharma, religious practice for salvation, or transcendence of the clutches of material contamination. Generally, people execute religious practices for economic development or sense gratification, but that is not recommended for one who wants to advance in yoga. The next important phrase is mitta medyanam, which means that one should eat very frugally. It is recommended in the Vedic literatures that a yogi eat only half what he desires according to his hunger. If one is so hungry that he could devour 1 pound of foodstuffs, then instead of eating 1 pound, he should consume only half a pound, and supplement this with 4 ounces of water. 1/4 of the stomach should be left empty for passage of air in the stomach. If one eats in this manner, he will avoid indigestion and disease. The yogi should eat in this way, as recommended in the Srimad Bhagavatam and all other standard scriptures. The yogi should live in a secluded place where his yoga practice will not be disturbed. Gramya dharma nivrittischa moksha dharma ratistata. Mitya medya dhanam shashvad vivikta kshema sevanam. One should cease performing conventional religious practices and should be attracted to those which lead to salvation. One should eat very frugally and should always remain secluded so that he can achieve the highest perfection of life. So, in this verse, Lord Kapila Dev is talking about real religion. We have the word dharma here twice, gramya dharma and moksha dharma. And of course, it's very interesting. Krishna also tells us to give up dharma. He just says sarva dharma, give up all kinds of dharma. But we also have, as Prabhupada's referring to in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, savaipum samparo dharma, yato bhaktir hoksajaya hoituki yaprityata yadyatma supersiditi. So, of course, there are people without any religion at all, at least without any formal God-oriented religion. everyone still has a religion, thinking that the universe came from nothing, that from nothing, somehow or other, we had the original singularity that was infinitely small, infinitely dense, and somehow it exploded and created laws of material nature and so forth. That is also a kind of religion. As the famous scientist Rupert Sheldrake points out, I think C.S. Lewis also says this, that as soon as you're saying, you know, the rock obeys the laws of gravity, you are talking about both a lawmaker and you are talking about that the rock has some kind of will to be a good citizen. So that's also a kind of religion. But most people follow some religion, whether it's a materialistic, mechanistic religion, or whether it's something which we normally think of as religion that involves some sort of higher being or beings in order to be happy in this world. If I figure out how the world works and if I propitiate the rulers of the world, if I follow the laws of the world, you know, the mechanistic atheists, they think if I can just figure out what the laws are, then I'll follow them and I'll become happy. And those who accept the existence of some sort of supreme being or beings think if I can follow the laws of that being or beings, and in addition, if I can propitiate that being or beings, then I will be happy. It's something like when you go to school, you quickly figure out that the key to getting a good education, or no, let's not say a good education, the key to getting good grades is, first of all, to follow the rules of the school and the individual teachers, but also to figure out the personality of the teachers. And you're trying to figure out the personality of the teacher, not so you can have a loving relationship, but so you know, okay, this teacher says I have to read chapter 5 by Wednesday, but the teacher never actually discusses chapter 5 in the class, nor is chapter 5 ever on the exams. So really all I have to do is take 5 minutes to look at the headings in chapter 5. So in other words, you're figuring out the personality of the teacher and the rules of the school so that you can, what we call, game the system, so that you can get your good grade and get out of there, and you really have no interest in anything other than that. So that's Gramya Dharma. That's ordinary religion. And here Lord Kapila Dev is saying, Nivritis. You don't... We have Pravritti and Nivritti, Pravritti Marg and Nivritti Marg. So here he's saying one of the things that one should give up is this Gramya Dharma. Now we should mention just very briefly, it's not going to be the main topic of our talk today, but just mentioning very briefly that Gramya Dharma is a very good thing for many people. We're not going to advise Gramya Dharma, which in the Vedic conception is Varnashram, to be given up for people in general. I had an experience of this many years ago. I was speaking to one, a devotee, whose whole focus in life was Varnashram Dharma. And their particular understanding of Varnashram Dharma, I should add, not necessarily the understanding, but their understanding of Varnashram Dharma. And they were very attached to that as the be-all and end-all. And in their mind, Varnashram Dharma and Krishna consciousness were totally equivalent. So, having been trained in debating skills, after some time, I was able to shake this person's faith in Varnashram as being equivalent to bhakti. But immediately I could understand that as their faith in Varnashram as being equivalent to bhakti was shaking, that what was going to happen was they were going to fall to adharma. They were not going to be able to go up to pure bhakti. They were going to fall down to adharma. So I immediately stopped. And I can understand that there's an offense, which is to preach the glories of the holy name to the faithless. And that offense in general means to try to get people to a position higher than they're capable of doing at that moment. Of course, one should also not engage people lower than they are capable of being in that moment. Such is an offense, to preach inappropriately. Therefore, for people in general, to follow Gramya Dharma is not a bad thing. And in fact, if Vedic religion rules the world, you have the majority of people are engaged in this Gramya Dharma. But as part of the, or Gramya means like village, ordinary. As part of the Vedic ordinary Dharma of Varnashram, one will come in contact with the Vedas, one will come in contact with literature like the Mahabharata, in which is the Bhagavad Gita. And one will come in contact with Brahmanas and perhaps saintly Vaishnavas, who will teach them that there is a higher Dharma. So it's very interesting here that Lord Kapiladeva is telling us to have rati, which we'll talk about more a little later, rati for moksha dharma, not only following moksha dharma, but with attachment. And that's quite interesting because generally we are told, like by Srila Rupa Goswami, that desires for both bhukti and mukti are like two witches that are hunting us. Not the bhukti and mukti are witches, but the desire for them is, just like Paul in the Bible said that the desire for money is the root of all evil. Not that money is the root of all evil, but the desire for it, the hankering for it. And it's very nicely explained by Jiva Goswami, I believe it's Jiva Goswami's commentary in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, that the desire for moksha, the desire for liberation, is also self-centered. One is thinking about my liberation. So one may wonder why Lord Kapiladeva is urging not only moksha dharma, but an attachment for it. And one could say that, well, that's a big step up, just like we would suggest varnashram dharma for those who are engaged in sinful activity, right? Just like when Prabhupada would find disciples, boyfriend, girlfriend, living together, he'd say, you should get married. I remember Satchabhama telling me that she and Paramananda were boyfriend and girlfriend. And first Prabhupada would say to them, what do you think about getting married? You know, would you like to get married? and then it was, when are you going to get married? Especially after they got initiated. So when are you going to get married? And then it was, this Sunday is an auspicious day for a wedding. We're going to hold a wedding ceremony. So Prabhupada would push people from adharma to ordinary varnashram dharma. And in the same way, one can push people from varnashram dharma to moksha dharma, basically from karma to gyan. But here Srila Prabhupada is identifying moksha dharma not as a selfish desire for liberation and freedom, but rather with pure bhakti, ananya bhakti. And you can tell that in the first paragraph here, where he's saying, transcendental devotional service of the Lord without reason or cause. So one wants to get freedom. One is aiming for freedom, but that's not the reason. So in other words, one is serving Krishna without freedom being the reason. Mama janmani janmani swari bhavatad bhakti ahoy tuki tuki. One is not worshipping Krishna to get free from material entanglement. One is worshipping Krishna simply to love him. Transcendental devotional service. And ahoy tuki apritiyata, Prabhupada's referring to, nothing can stop it. It has no reason other than love, and nothing can stop it. The purity of our devotion can be measured to at least in some extent by how much impediments stop it. So if we get some material advantage, do we get slack in our devotion? If we have some material disadvantage, do we get slack in our devotion? If it's hard to do our sadhana, many devotees think, well, the whole key is just to set up my life so it will be easy for sadhana, which is what we're going to be speaking about in a moment, how to do that. But of course, that's not entirely possible in the material world. And they think, well, until I've set everything up so it's easy for sadhana, I won't do it. So that's an impediment. And by its performance, one actually becomes satisfied. Actually means that it's a satisfaction without satiation. It's a satisfaction which is eternal. It's a satisfaction which is, as Prabhupada would often say, the true interest or best interest of the soul. So Srila Prabhupada, as he always does, explains the statements in the Shastra to point to bhakti, even when by a literal translation of this verse, one may not take it that way. If we say moksha dharma ratihi, one should have an attachment for moksha dharma. Moksha dharma could be interpreted to include goals and practices which are not bhakti. It could include basically all the other yogas, the karma yoga, jnana yoga, and dhyana yoga, it could even include such systems as Buddhism and so forth. So someone just reading the Sanskrit could take it that way, but Srila Prabhupada, just like in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada will translate verses where Krishna is talking about karma yoga or buddhi yoga, and Prabhupada will translate them and explain them as bhakti yoga, which brings for Srila Prabhupada some criticism sometimes from scholars. Oh, he's trying to have his own point. But Prabhupada here is translating this way because he's understanding this verse in the context of the whole. He's understanding that Lord Kapiladeva is very, very clearly in his instructions to Devahuti teaching bhakti, teaching Vishnu bhakti. And therefore, if Lord Kapiladeva is saying moksha dharma rati, if he's saying rati, actually have attachment, not just have a practice, but have attachment, he's not going to urge attachment to something other than Vishnu bhakti, pure Vishnu bhakti. So then in the remainder of this verse and the other half of the purport, Srila Prabhupada, Lord Kapiladeva, speak about three items that are very helpful to achieving attachment for moksha dharma and are very helpful to achieving moksha dharma, the goal of it. So these are the practices. So we have, of course, sambandha abhideyam prayojana. So in one sense, your relationship is that of attachment. One has some attachment to the process. Rupa Goswami, in fact, says in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that this taste for bhakti is one's primary qualification for taking up bhakti. So some taste, some attachment in the beginning with the goal, the prayojana, of course, having a full taste, a complete taste of prema. And the abhideya, we can say usually the abhideya is you do things which will increase your attachment. But here we're being given three prescriptive practices, which are rather interesting. And we're going to look at each of them in turn. Srila Prabhupada only talks about two of them in the purport. But as all three of them are in the verse, we're going to speak about all three of them. These are practices that are highly recommended to take our attachment to Krishna, to take our attachment to transcendent uttam bhakti moksha dharma, and to fan that spark of attachment until it's a blazing flame. And I think this is of concern to all of us on the path of bhakti. We all have a little attachment. And just like, if we didn't, we wouldn't be here. Just like Sanatana Goswami says in... not Sanatana Goswami, I'm sorry. Rupa Goswami says in the Stavamala, when he has the prayer, Deva Bhavantam Vande, he says that my attachment to you is just like a little sesame seed, just like a little tila. But I'm hoping that you, because you can do Durgata Gata Navidate, that you can make the impossible possible, that you will take my sesame seed of attachment and you will make it into a whole plant, a flowering plant. So how do we do this? So the three things here we're told is medya adinam, mitya medya adinam, a little bit of pure eating. So to do a little bit of pure eating. That doesn't mean to do a little bit of pure eating and a lot of impure eating. It means to eat purely and not too much. And then we have shashvat vivikta, always be secluded. Shema, be peaceful. Kshema also means to be forgiving, and peace and forgiveness are very related. Dwelling, sevanam, to have an always secluded and peaceful, forgiving dwelling. So first we're going to look at eating. So Srila Prabhupada here, interestingly enough, does not write in the purport at all about prasadam or even vegetarianism. Srila Prabhupada simply writes about Ayurvedic scientific principles of eating so as to avoid indigestion and disease. Now, that fact alone, that Srila Prabhupada's writing about Ayurvedic principles rather than vegetarianism or prasadam, is noteworthy. So there are many times when Srila Prabhupada will say that we don't preach vegetarianism, we preach prasadam. There's many times where he says that. And because he says that in many places, there are devotees who feel that if we speak about vegetarianism without speaking simultaneously about prasadam, that we are doing something improper. However, if one reads Srila Prabhupada's books carefully, one will find that there are many, many purports and also many times in lectures, and certainly many times in conversations, where Srila Prabhupada only talks about being vegetarian, or sometimes Prabhupada only talks about protecting cows. He doesn't even speak about other animals or write about other animals. So if you take some purports or lectures or conversations just separately and look at those just individually, you will find that in certain circumstances and certain contexts, Srila Prabhupada does indeed speak only about vegetarianism or only about cow protection and not about offering one's food. And in this purport, he's looking at Ayurvedic principles. Many years ago, when I was a Gurukul teacher, I had a policy that the high school students could request that we add an elective course to our offerings that was in their particular interest. And generally what that meant was that I would have to procure a course simply for them. And sometimes it meant that I had to learn the course along with the students and just stay a few steps ahead of them. So we had some students interested in Ayurveda, and therefore I was able, it was really nice, I was able to get a course from an institute of Ayurveda that taught through distance learning. And normally it was quite expensive, but that what they said was that I could pay for the course for myself, and then I could get additional courses free, with just the cost of the materials, for my students, and then I could teach my students. So I went through a year's independent study, distance learning. I was working with professors in Ayurveda. And one of the main things, or the main thing really, that stuck with me throughout the course and just kind of popped out to me as I was going through the course, was that many of the practical life items that Srila Prabhupada taught us were based in Ayurvedic science. It just fascinated me, because many times Srila Prabhupada doesn't make that explicit. I mean, in this particular purport, he makes it very explicit. It is recommended in the Vedic literatures, he says. But other things are not so explicit. You just don't know, what is the reason for it. Why is Srila Prabhupada, why does Prabhupada say that in the marriage ceremony the husband should cover his wife's head, for example? And he says, covering her head is a symptom of a married woman's shyness. So why? Where does that come from? Is that just some folklore? Is it just something from Muslim influence? People have their different theories. But you'll find that it's actually based in Ayurvedic principles. It's just fascinating. Or telling us to wake up in the morning before 4 o'clock in the morning. Why do we do that? I mean, Prabhupada's saying, okay, there's this time of the day and it's very auspicious, but when you study the Ayurveda, you find out why it's auspicious. You're like, that's what's going on. And you start realizing that everything Srila Prabhupada gave us was based in Shastric science. It wasn't just some whimsical thing. That the Vedic literature is very interconnected. And so the philosophical basis, the practical basis, they're all related to each other. You have in many of the religious systems of the world today, it's not like that. You read the Bible and it's really not that clear. It's not, or the Quran, there's not that much information, and certainly it's not given in some integrated scientific way about how to live your life practically. A lot of the information on practical living, people have to extrapolate, and they have to really extrapolate. Now, in this particular purport, Prabhupada's advising us to eat half of what we want to eat in order to have proper digestion and freedom from disease. Of course, we have some great devotees like Bhima, who didn't follow such instruction, but he is called Vrikodhar. He had a wolf belly, and he could digest anything. And so, of course, if one has very strong digestion, then one may be able to eat a lot. But for most of us, our health of our body is very related not only to what we eat, but how much we eat and how we eat. So, of course, now in the world today, especially in a country like America, gross overeating is a huge problem. And one really notices it when one travels out of America, that the percentage of grossly obese people decreases as soon as one gets out of America. But not in some places it's worse. I mean, I know when I first visited Trinidad and Tobago, I was astonished at the number, particularly of women,
who were really, really obese once they could hit like 30, 40 years old. It was sort of the norm. So certain ethnicities of people, whether it's something genetic or something in cultural habits, or I would guess most likely some combination of both, tend to have a culture of gross overeating, which, you know, makes it very difficult for the upcoming generations. We were taught our eating habits as a child, and if it's part of our culture, it may be very difficult. So there's this concept that one should not eat too much. And of course, the interesting thing, we don't have time to get into this in depth, is some time ago I read a book called The Alchemy of Air, which was about the development of artificial fertilizers, basically from capturing the nitrogen in the air. And the authors made the point that until the development of artificial fertilizers, we were growing less food on the planet. If we're simply confined to manure and rotting plants and things of that kind, the amount of food that we could take from the soil was more limited. And that at the present time, we're able to grow much more food by using artificial fertilizers. Aha! But what are we doing with this food? We are growing now, I believe, I may be getting the statistics wrong, we are growing now, I think, twice as much food with artificial fertilizers as we were growing with natural fertilizers, but we are wasting half of the food that is grown. So think about that for a moment. We are wasting half of the food that is grown. A lot of that food doesn't even make it to the consumer. A lot of that food is just, it's grown, it's harvested, and it's trashed. And then the food that doesn't make it to the stores. And then in the stores, a lot of the food is not purchased. It's again, trashed. And then once it gets into people's homes, a lot of it is trashed. I mean, I visit people's homes as I travel the world, and the amount of food waste, especially in some homes, is just startling. It's really, it's just startling. So, we're growing all this food. By using artificial fertilizers, and again, I haven't memorized it. I should probably do this because it's so fascinating. But by growing artificial fertilizers, we've upset the balance of nature. We've upset the balance in the soil. We've upset the balance in the oceans. And we've upset the balance in the air. Creating artificial fertilizers has created a certain kind of pollution for the soil and the water and the air, which is putting the balance of nature all out of whack. To grow double the amount of food so we can waste half of it. And then, of course, artificial fertilizers are also used for ammunition. So the same factories that produce artificial fertilizer in Germany, which had the patent on the process for quite some time, also became the main munitions factory because it's the same chemical. So we are, and then the food we are eating nowadays, so we are growing more food and we're having this abundance of food. I mean, wow, you know, in what we call the developed countries, you go to these supermarkets, wow, and the amount of food, the variety of food, is just mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling. But most of the food in that supermarket is full of chemicals. So my son, who ran a prasadam business for many years, told me that most of the food you buy in the supermarket, even the natural stuff, has been sitting around for 6 to 12 months before you eat it. They used to make these granola bars, offered granola bars. And you know, when you ate them right there at the factory, it was a little different taste than when you bought them in the shop, because in the factory they were fresh. In the shop they were 6 to 12 months old because of the food distribution systems. And that means that even the fresh fruits and vegetables, they're being picked unripe. They're being artificially ripened. Because they're not tree ripened, they don't have the full quota of nutrients and they don't have the full taste and so forth. So nowadays we are eating too much, but we are eating too much of food that is grown in terrible ways and food that itself is barely could barely be termed food. And then we wonder why we are so diseased, why there is so much cancer, why there is so much heart disease, why there is so much mental illness. It's so on and on and on. The list of diseases is just startling. How many people are taking medication for, you know, allergies, for pain, for, and a lot of these problems can be traced to our diet. So not to eat too much, to eat the right amount, but also of the right food, and to eat food in a way that's in harmony with the environment. And how wonderful it is that Srila Prabhupada gave us a system that's not only transcendent, but that's also in harmony with the planet, that's also ecological. You know, we don't have a philosophy that God's given us dominion over the earth, and therefore in our dominion, we can wreck the earth and do whatever we want with it. You know, it's just like if your parents say, you know, here's a toy for you. They don't mean here's a toy for you to break. They mean here's a toy for you to take care of. One second. So this is very, it's a very holistic practice that we're following. Now, of course, with prasadam, sometimes Srila Prabhupada would tell the devotees to eat a lot of prasadam, and sometimes Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would feed devotees a lot of prasadam. It is said that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would feed the devotees so much prasadam that they'd be filled up to their neck, that he wouldn't be able to give them less than 10 people could eat. And because of this practice of his, Swarup Damodar, the other devotees, would tell Lord Chaitanya to sit down and let them serve. But of course they also wanted him to sit down because they said the devotees won't eat as long as you're serving and not eating. They want to see that you eat first. Of course, when we eat, we should also think not only about how is the we should think about, you know, how is the food grown? Is the food pure? We have that word medya, is the food, sorry. Is the food pure? Is it grown purely? Is it harvested purely? Is it made of pure ingredients? And then, of course, is it cooked and offered to Krishna by pure persons with love? And then we should eat that food. It's not only the amount of food that we should be conscious of, but also our mood of eating the food. One should be eating our prasadam as a way of honoring the Lord. Honoring the Lord. Well, Krishna has eaten this. And just like even materially, people want a little piece of cloth from, you know, Elvis Presley's jacket. So we want the food that Krishna has eaten, the food that Guru has eaten. So the next point here is seclusion. So to always be secluded. And this point about seclusion, of course, we could say, well, this point isn't really relevant for us who are followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because we are a preaching movement. So, of course, there are many religious systems that urge general seclusion. They urge seclusion for individuals, you know, the monks and nuns who live in a cloistered hermitage. You have these old hermitages in Europe that are up on a cliff, for example, and they have their entrance and exit is in a floor. It's an opening in a floor through which they raise and lower a bucket once a day or once a week where the villagers give them supplies they can't have on the top of the mountain. And that's pretty cloistered. Or, you know, one of my students in Bhaktivedanta College shared with me a video of these monks who have a vow of silence. And 6.5 days a week, they're in complete silence and complete seclusion. I mean, they come together 3 times a day for group prayer. Other than that, they're just in their room and they're just like given their food under the door. Nobody talks to each other. And 1/2 day a week, they all go out of the monastery and they have games and they talk to each other. So they're not silent 24/7. But they're not only secluded from society in general, they're even secluded from each other. Of course, you know, those who work in the kitchen or whatever, they're working with each other, but without speaking. So that's really, you know, total seclusion. So we have that kind of seclusion for the renunciates, for the ascetics. But you also have whole communities which seclude themselves. And we think of, in modern society, the Orthodox Jews form their own little ghettos. And of course, some of that practice comes from the fact that they have a rule that you cannot drive to their temple, to their synagogues on the Sabbath or on the festival days, but you are also enjoined to go. So that means you have to live within walking distance. And because of that rule, you will find that the Orthodox Jews live in very close proximity to each other and to their houses of worship. And this is also, their practices isolate them from the world. So the very Orthodox Jews will not have full internet access. They won't watch TV or movies. They won't have any artwork on their walls other than pictures of rabbis. They dress in ways that are radically different from the rest of society. They eat in ways that are different from the rest of society. They don't allow their children to attend regular colleges and universities, which of course then limits what kind of careers that they can have. And they're very insulated. Many Orthodox Jewish communities also speak to each other in Yiddish, which of course is not a biblical language. That's a cultural language. It was a combination of Hebrew and Polish. But they speak to each other in Yiddish. They have their own Yiddish newspapers. Many of them have very poor English. So their whole community is secluded. The Amish also today are in a very similar situation. I'd say the Amish are even much more secluded than the Orthodox Jews, because the Amish will not even regularly use telephones, at least not in their home. They will not use cars, and they will not educate their children past the age of 14. So they're extremely secluded. They have even stricter rules where their whole community becomes very secluded. So these are two prime examples in the modern world of communities that seclude themselves. And we have whole countries like this. Saudi Arabia has a whole principle of seclusion. Saudi Arabia does not, as far as I know, at least they didn't a year ago, issue tourist visas at all. You simply cannot get a tourist visa. You can only get a visa to visit if you have some very particular business. And their holy cities of Mecca and Medina are off limits to non-Muslims. Non-Muslims cannot enter the city at all. So they're very, very strict. A woman can only enter Saudi Arabia if she's wearing a burqa and if she's in the company of some male relative. So they control the internet and so forth. And then we have non-religious societies that have principles of seclusion, like Burma for many years, which has another name, Myanmar or something. And then China, of course, also tries to seclude its citizen. I believe North Korea also, that they don't allow various kinds of social media, they don't allow certain internet sites, certain internet searches, and so forth, so that the citizens are more or less secluded. And you have many people in our Hare Krishna movement who believe that such a policy of seclusion, at least on a community level, if not on an individual level, is desired. I know many devotees who think like this. They think the best kind of education for our children is an education of seclusion. They think that our community should be very insular and very inward-looking and cut off from the world as far as possible. However, we are a preaching movement, and as a preaching movement, as Gosti and Undis, we are not going to be secluded. We should not be secluded. You know, we should keep in mind that religious societies that are secluded are not preaching movements. You know, the more secluded they are, the less preaching that they are doing. Those religious societies propagate themselves pretty much entirely through physical reproduction and not through preaching to the world. They don't really claim, like the Amish and the Orthodox Jews, they don't claim to be universal movements. Of course, Islam does, and they want to impose their regulations on the rest of the world. But it's interesting if we think about it. So because the very strict Muslims have this policy both of seclusion and preaching, the means by which they preach tend to be very violent. Just think about that for a minute. There's some relationship between having very secluded communities and a preaching society with having violent means of preaching. And they've had violent means of preaching from the beginning. It's not a new thing. So very secluded societies tend to not preach at all or to preach very violently. They have a very us and them mentality. So if we want to preach in a blissful way, Kevala Nandakanda, immediately it precludes us being secluded in that sense. But yet we're told to be secluded. And in fact, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we are a preaching mission. He says, Asat Sangha Tyaga, a Vaishnava Chala. How do you know a Vaishnava? They give up Asat Sangha. So how do we work in the world and give up Asat Sangha? How do we seclude ourselves? Well, on a very practical day-to-day basis, we should have, as far as possible, a place for our daily sadhana that is secluded from the world. We have, you know, in many cities of the world, we have temples where people gather. Used to be we would all gather there for Mangalarti, though that's become rather passé. But at least we can have a place in our home, a little sacred space in our home. Even if you're traveling, you can set up a little sacred space that's secluded. It's away from the hustle and bustle. You know, it's not, it's away from the things you have to do. It's just where there is your deities, there is your altar. And if you can't do that in your home, then you go to sit in a garden. Go sit by a body of water. Go sit by in a garden. And go someplace for your sadhana where one can be secluded. To try to do one's sadhana during the hustle and bustle of life is not recommended anywhere. And also our intimate associates should be devotees. The six loving exchanges we should be doing with the devotees. In his Prabhupada's purport to the six loving exchanges and nectar of instruction, he mentions that one should not engage in these six loving exchanges with the impersonalists, with the Mayavadis, or with the atheists. So, although we're interacting with the world, we do not seclude ourselves from the world. We interact from the world, and not just that we go interact with the world as preachers and then run back into our cave. No. We are meant to produce people who will be the leaders of society. We are meant to have the teachers, the professors of religion in the universities, the government leaders, the heads of businesses, the leaders in the arts, the sciences, should all be devotees. The leaders in agriculture, we want to infiltrate the world through our career. We don't want to just all be hiding in some farm in the middle of nowhere and just run into the society to preach and then run back to our farm. I mean, some people can live like that, but not all of us. We are also meant to integrate into society, to change society. I mean, otherwise, if we made everyone in the world devotees of Krishna, would that mean that all of society would collapse? No, it means it would be spiritualized. Some things would collapse or be greatly reduced, but we are meant to integrate society. So the seclusion means that we need secluded time. We need time away from the world to be just with Krishna in our sadhana. That is essential. Without doing that, we will become weak. I was just speaking to one of the devotees in the local community the other day, who was telling me how she really wanted to work on a devotional project that her mother had started. She said, but in order to work on this project, one has to have good sadhana. She said, I'm finding that, you know, my husband and I, we're just watching movies and getting up late, and we don't really have any sadhana. And she said, and my ability to do this service is compromised. So I was thinking, it's a fact, you know, if we don't have some time where it's just, where we're just with devotees in Krishna, where we're secluded from the world to do our sadhana, we're not going to be effective preachers. We're not going to be effective in our mission. We're not going to be effective at anything. And the last thing that Loka Piladev says in this verse, which Prabhupada does not speak about in the purport, is kshema. Kshema means to be peaceful. Now, you could take it that it's vivikta kshema sevanam, that one should have a secluded, peaceful dwelling. So you could take it that Prabhupada's speaking about it where he says the yogi should live in a secluded place where his yoga practice will not be disturbed. But shame also means a particular state of mind, and it particularly means forgiveness. So you can have the best, we can have the best technical sadhana. You know, get up at 3:45 and have all your 16 rounds done by 6:30, and you do pukka puja, and you analyzing every word of the shastra in regard to bhakti. But if we're not forgiving, we will not be peaceful and we will not be satisfied. Why is forgiveness very related to peace? Because what causes our peace, our lack of peace, is thinking, oh, this person has offended me, that person has offended me. This is not going my way, that is not going my way. We forget that everything goes Krishna's way. Bhaktiram yakatapasam sarvalokamaheshram suridam sarvabhutanam gyatvamam shantim richichi, that one will attain shanti or kshema. Only if one sees everything that's happening is the will of the Lord, and the will of the Lord loves me. And if by the will of the Lord, this person has been allowed to insult me, or to hurt me, or to cheat me, or to betray me, then that must be for my benefit, because he is my best friend. Indeed, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati says, one who criticizes me is my friend, and one who flatters me is my enemy. So to forgive. Forgive means that, on the most basic level, I mean, I have a whole seminar on forgiveness, but the sutra of forgiveness is, may those who have hurt me learn their lessons in a joyful way. May I take it that Krishna is using this person for my benefit, to teach me something, and may this person learn what they need to learn without suffering. The opposite of forgiveness is, you've hurt me, now I'm going to hurt you. Or I hope that you get hurt. Right? That was Dhruva's problem. He was so angry at his stepmother and stepbrother that he wanted them to suffer. And then they did. You know, his stepbrother was killed, or half-brother. I always call him stepbrother. His half-brother was killed, and his stepmother was also killed. Like Lord Vishnu responded to his desire for vengeance, which Dhruva immediately regretted. And he regretted it so much that when his brother Uttam did die at the hands of a yaksha, that Dhruva overcompensated in killing the yakshas out of love for his brother, and perhaps guilt at feeling responsible indirectly for his brother's death. So our peacefulness comes with forgiveness. If we are walking around resentful, why do I have to do this? Why do I have to do that? Why did this person do this? I'm not getting to do what I want to do. I'm not being treated the way I want to be treated. You know, we've given our lives to Krishna. And then after giving our lives to Krishna, we still want to be the controller and the Lord of everything in our lives. How I spend my time, how people treat me, how people deal with me. I want that to be, you know, that's under my control. So forgiveness is letting go of resentment, letting go of bitterness, letting go of a desire for vengeance. It's letting it go and seeing everything that happens is happening by the mercy of the Lord, and everything is therefore a blessing. Right? Everything is a blessing. Tatena kampam sukshamakshamana. Offering more obeisances to the Lord when there's whatever the difficulty may be. Adiatmik, adidaivik, adibhautik. No resentment. No resentment. Even no resentment at ourselves. Not, I'm suffering because of my past misdeeds. Oh, I hate myself that I'm such an idiot. No, forgiving oneself too. Forgive them, Lord, they don't know what they do, Jesus said on the cross. And forgive ourselves too. I do not resent myself. Whatever I have done has been out of, you know, foolishness or madness, as Arjuna said to Krishna in the 11th chapter. Let go of resentment. The good things, the bad things, they're all the blessings of the Lord. And this way one becomes peaceful. And this way one becomes peaceful even, you know, on the crowded subway train at rush hour. What to speak of in a secluded place. So here we are given some practices that will help us in our ultimate moksha dharma, rati, to be attached to the process of devotion, to fan our love for the Lord, to fan our feeling of attachment, to have pure eating to eat a proper, a healthy amount of, in a pure way. To have times and places of seclusion and away from the hubbub of the world, and to become peaceful, not just because we have our external environment set up that way, but because we are forgiving. But the point of all this, the point of how we eat, the point of how we worship, the point of our internal state, is not to gain moksha for our own self, because that is also, that desire is also a witch. The point is to love Mukunda, the giver of liberation. Just like when Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya turned from being an impersonalist to a devotee, he wanted to change the Bhagavatam from Muktipada to Bhaktipada. And Lord Chaitanya was very pleased with him, but he said, no, you don't change the Bhagavatam. So our attachment, Muktipada, pada means feet, this moksha dharma is at the feet of the Lord. It's not an impersonal moksha. It's not a selfish moksha that we're looking for here. And therefore, one has attachment to it. Ratihi. That attachment is not to the concept of being free. The attachment is to the lotus feet of he who gives freedom. The reason for wanting freedom at all, the reason to being attached to being free, is it only in a free state can we actually serve the Lord? Brahma Bhutta Prasanatma Nasarchachina Kanchati Sama Sarveshu Bhuteshu Mad Bhakti Labhate Param. We cannot serve Krishna properly in a contaminated state. Just like in our puja, first we bathe and then we do puja. So before we can really become attached to Krishna, we also have to be free from the modes of material nature. And these three processes, how we eat, to what extent we remove ourselves from the contamination of the world, and how much we give out resentment will certainly help in that process. So today the grandchildren are all gone, and therefore I don't need to meet with them immediately to do a morning program with them, although I do have worship that I do myself. But I can take a few minutes to answer questions. So if anyone has questions.
Does forgiveness preclude avoiding that person, practically shutting them out of our life? We forgive them, but if we don't think there's anything we can do to help them, totally avoid them.
That's you can both avoid somebody and forgive them. Forgiveness, what I've understand from studying the Shastra, is that forgiveness essentially means that I wish them well and I don't wish them harm. That's essentially what forgiveness it means. It also means that I see that person as the agent of God, that Krishna has some reason why this person was allowed to harm me, ostensibly. No one can really harm me. If God is all good and God is all powerful, then everything that happens must be under his control and must be good. That's just logic. Right? If he's the Sarvalokamaheshwaram and Suridam Sarvabhutanam, which is what brings peace, then he must have allowed that person to hurt me, or even instigated that person to hurt me, perhaps. And it must be for my benefit. So forgiveness is understanding this was given ultimately by the Lord for my benefit in some way. And sometimes the benefit is that one understands that one should leave. I mean, sometimes we're in a situation that's not good for us. It's not good for our spiritual life. It's not good for us on any level. And we're in that situation because of some sort of improper attachment. And the hurtful behavior of others acts to break that attachment so that we're able to leave that situation. So sometimes that's the lesson that Krishna wants us to learn. You know, and we see this circumstance in the Bhagavatam where Maharaj Anga gave up his family life because of the behavior of his son, Vena. We see this with the Bhagavatam itself, with Maharaj Parikit, where the curse of Sringi, which he could have counteracted, It said that he saw that the Lord had taken the form of the curse. And therefore, he used it as an opportunity to leave not only his responsibilities in the kingdom and family, but also the world, We have Vidura, who when he was insulted by Duryodhana and threatened, the Acharyas say that he was, that when Duryodhana said, leave him with only his breath, that Vidura understood that Duryodhana was threatening to beat him to within a hair of life. And so he took that as, oh, Krishna's telling me that I need to get out of here. And he also, he renounced his career. He retired. He retired from his career. He retired from family life. He became a vanaprastha. So sometimes that is the lesson. And sometimes it may be another lesson. Sometimes it may be a lesson in compassion. Sometimes it may be a lesson that the way this person is treating me, I'm also treating someone else. I mean, there's an infinite number of variety of lessons that others harming us can be there, but there's always some good in it. So forgiveness means I see that ultimately Krishna is doing this. I don't blame the perpetrator. Dharma the Bull says if you blame the perpetrator, you're as bad as the perpetrator. I mean, in conventional sense, you can point out to the police officer who is the thief and so forth. But you don't blame the perpetrator for your suffering. You say that you blame Krishna in a sense, but neither do you blame Krishna, you glorify Krishna. And that you wish the perpetrator well. You don't, just like Draupadi, when Asvatthama killed her children and then he was brought before her, she says his mother has lost her husband in the battle, she only has this one child. If she were to lose her child, if we were to execute her child, then she would be crying like me. I don't want her to cry like me at the loss of her children. So that is the opposite of vengeance. Vengeance is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You've killed my child, I will kill your child. Vengeance is, you have made me suffer, I want you to suffer equally or greater. Forgiveness is, you have made me suffer, may you not suffer. May you not suffer how you have made me suffer. May you not suffer in any way. If you need to learn a lesson, if your behavior is improper and you need to learn a lesson, may you learn that lesson joyfully, the way I would like to learn a lesson. As Suniti told Dhruva, do not wish harm for others. Anyone who wishes harm to others will themselves suffer from that very same thing. But wishing well to others, wishing that others do not get harmed, seeing the hand of God, does not indicate at all what external actions one should take with that person. And in my experience, the only way to know what external actions one should take with that person have to come after seeing Krishna's hand and wishing well to that person. Because when one sees Krishna's hand and wishes well to that person, one comes at least to sattva-gun or to bhakti. And only in sattva-gun or bhakti can one know what is to be done, what is not to be done, what is binding, what is liberating. And after one has wished the person well, after one has seen the hand of God in this for one's own life, then one is situated in goodness, and then one can understand, oh, does that mean that I should still try to have a relationship with this person in the same way we did before? Does it mean that I should have a different kind of relationship with this person? Or does it mean that I should have no relationship with this person?
Great answer.
Sorry for the long answer.
That's great. Thank you.
Mother Irma?
Yeah, I see your question. Oh, I'm sorry, Ramananda, I see your question. There's evidently in the skull, you know, any of you who've had little babies, so when a human baby's born, the plates of the skull are very movable, and that's so that the baby's head can squish to be born. And in fact, many newborn babies have an elongated skull which gradually returns to the normal shape. And in the baby has two soft spots in the skull, one right at the top of the head and one kind of toward the back of the head, which eventually fuse, though not entirely. I mean, we still have indentation in our skull where these soft spots were. And light affects us through these parts of the skull. I mean, light is affecting us. We are eating light. We eat light through our skin, of course. That is very well known. We also eat light through our eyes. And light is nourishing us. Again, according to modern science, we are actually being nourished by light. There's at least vitamin D, that the main source of vitamin D for most human beings is through light. So we don't survive on light to the extent that a plant does, but we do live on light. And light also affects the hormonal balance and the chemical balance in our body. So light going through the top of our skull affects our hormonal balance, and it actually it causes some disturbance. So the covering of the head for a woman, particularly for a married woman, helps her body to be in proper balance and more. Because women, particularly during their reproductive years, have this roller coaster of hormones. And so restricting the sunlight through the top of the head actually helps those hormones to be more in balance. So that's quite interesting. There may be other psychological reasons also why married women particularly want to cover their hair, that a woman's hair is understood to be one of the main means of which the womanly beauty attracts a man, and to reserve that aspect of her beauty for her husband is also a way of helping her to focus her attention on her husband. So there may be that psychological basis also, and that particularly why did it happen in marriage, because before marriage the woman's romantic feelings were not so awakened, you know, under a civilized society. So before marriage, people don't have sexual relations before marriage. Not only, you know, coitus, but not even any kind of, in a civilized society, people are not even holding hands before marriage. And without any actual contact, the desires are not fully awakened. So it's only in marriage for the girl that they become fully awakened. And once they're fully awakened, then keeping the head covered also allows her to reserve those things for marriage. So it helps her. And also signals, it acted as a signal, just like, you know, we have wedding rings, so it acted as a signal to others that I'm a married woman. But yeah, it also has some physical health. And when I read that, I was like, whoa, that is really interesting. So anybody else have another question?
Mother Urmila, could you speak something about the Lord Jesus and Gaudiya Vaishnavism?
Well, it's interesting. I did not grow up as a Christian. I first read the New Testament when I was 14. And I've never read all of it. I read the Gospels, Revelation, little bits here and there. I have read a lot of Christian authors, and I've read a lot of I've read a lot of the works of the Catholic mystics. I definitely have more familiarity with Christianity than I do with Islam, with which I have very little knowledge. Srila Prabhupada said that if you love Krishna, you must love Jesus, and if you love Jesus, you must love Krishna. We see Jesus as the Son of God, as a Shaktivesh avatar, an empowered teacher. Srila Prabhupada, when initiating devotees and speaking about the 10 offenses, when he spoke about that one should not blaspheme the devotees who've dedicated their lives to propagating the holy name of the Lord, he would often give the example of Jesus and Muhammad. He would say, Jesus and Muhammad may be teaching something not as elevated, but we should not blaspheme them. And for me personally, One of my main attractions to accepting Srila Prabhupada as my spiritual master was and remains the fact that Srila Prabhupada never taught a sectarian view. He never said, never. He would say, we're not converting people from Christians to Hindus. You can go on and be a Christian. Jesus is our guru. And very much so. And in fact, when I read the four Gospels and then I read Bhagavad Gita, I said, well, you know, Jesus is essentially preaching the same thing. It's very compatible. So modern Christianity, most sects of modern Christianity, in modern Christianity, the different sects are so different that it's really a stretch to say that they're the same religion. You know, there are many Christians who, for example, don't consider the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Mormons to be real Christians. But even if you want to look at, say, the Amish and the Mennonites, who most Christians would accept to be real Christians. They are so radically different from, you know, like the Southern Baptists. they have commonality. They use the same scripture and they have the same teacher, or the Seventh-day Adventists, or, you know, they're really so radically different. So in the actual practice and philosophy of Christianity as it has evolved after Christ, we have to remember that when Christ was on the planet, he did not write anything down. There were no recording devices, and therefore our knowledge of what he said and what he did is based on things long after his disappearance. Unlike Srila Prabhupada. You know, Srila Prabhupada. I mean, my friend Rukmini, a.k.a. Dr. Ruchira Dutta, who's took Harinam from Bhakti Pramod Puri Maharaj. So her mother wrote a book of Puri Maharaj's biography, and it was there that Puri Maharaj was the recording device for Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. So when Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati would give a lecture, Puri Maharaj, when he was a brahmachari primarily, would be writing down, you know, just like when I was a little girl, my father had a secretary who learned shorthand and would be, you know, recording everything in shorthand. Nowadays we use machines to record, and then people transcribe what's on the machines, or increasingly the machines can transcribe themselves. So with Srila Prabhupada, we have so many video recordings, audio recordings, profuse books that he wrote. With Jesus, it's not like that, and it's definitely a disadvantage to understand what Jesus taught. The fact of us not having such recordings means that the proliferation of a wide range of philosophies and practices that are said to be Christian, it's very hard to know which of those are things that Jesus are related to what Jesus has taught. It's really a problem. And especially when you consider that Jesus was a teacher within Judaism. He was not founding his own... he said, I've not come to deny any of the law of Moses. So he was a teacher within Judaism. And it was only later when his grand disciples, started with his grand disciples and great-grand disciples, etc., decided that they wanted to do two things. They wanted to preach beyond Jews. They wanted to preach to non-Jews. They wanted to bring non-Jews as followers of Jesus. That was actually the main thing that they decided. And because of that decision, they felt that they wanted to differentiate themselves from their Jewish roots. And this sort of question also arises with us, that if we're going to preach Krishna consciousness beyond those who are born Hindus, who are ethnically Indian, to what extent, in order to reach those people, do we divorce ourselves from the Hindu roots? You know, we often say that we're not Hindus, and, you know, there's this big debate going on as to what extent aspects of Indian culture should be part of our mission. So the grand disciples of Jesus, they decided not only to jettison Jewish culture, but they also decided to jettison a lot of the rules of Judaism. So, for example, they got rid of the Jewish dietary rules. And then once you got rid of everything in Judaism, they got rid of the rituals of Judaism. Even though a lot of them, not all of them, of course, but a lot of them came from the Bible itself. All right, but how are you going to have a religion without rituals? That's going to be a little tough. So they invented their own. They invented their own liturgy. They invented their own rituals. They basically made them up. I mean, there's just no other way to put it. They made them up. And you could say, well, you know, our acharyas have done that to some extent, too. I mean, Srila Prabhupada has this thing, the Guru Vastika, every morning. That's not from Shastra. That's from one of our acharyas. So we do have aspects of what we could call our liturgy that come from our acharyas rather than coming from the Shastra. And if if you're part of ISKCON, you're going to sing certain songs that are not going to be sung by Gaudiya Vaishnavas who are followers of Narottama Das Thakur. Because, you know, we're going to be singing the songs of Bhaktivinoda, but Bhaktivinoda's not in their line. Just like Prabhupada always sang Jai Radha Madhava, but that's not going to be sung. The Gaudiyas in Manipur who are coming from Narottama Das Thakur, you know, the Gaudiyas in Radhakund that are coming from Shamananda, they're not going to sing Jai Radha Madhava because Bhaktivinoda is not an acharya in their line. And, I mean, I notice this even if I go to something by other followers of Bhaktisiddhanta who who are not coming through A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, that they will sing the Gaur Artik song differently, for example. They'll put things in the song that in ISKCON we don't put. So, there's, you know, I'm not picking on Christianity in this respect. But in any case, the point is that what happened in Christianity is such that the relationship between modern Christian practices in terms of what kind of worship they do and so forth is often very, very separate from what Jesus taught. And it's hard to trace out a line between what Jesus taught, what he lived, what he expected disciples to do, and what these different branches of Christianity today actually do. And that's it makes it very difficult for us to say, well, we revere Jesus and we respect Jesus, and at the same time, how do we deal with all these different types of Christianity? I mean, you definitely have followers of Jesus like St. Francis and St. Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross. I mean, you have people like that who, I would say without question, based on our Shastra, achieved very high levels of Bhagavan realization. I would say St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila achieved Madhurya Bhav, if their writings are accurate. So a follower of Jesus, I mean, what that tells me is that a follower of Jesus, even, you know, 1,000 years after he left the planet, and even working within institutions which have unquestionably distorted teachings and believe both beliefs and rituals in ways that did not come from him and that he never intended, and he'd be like, well, what are you doing? is he still, because of their connection with Jesus, they are able to attain Madhurya Bhav. That's interesting. And situations like that should give us great pause as to what extent, you know, getting doctrine exactly correct and getting practices exactly correct, like some sort of smarta brahmana, is really what we're after. Today's a good day, I mean, to pick up the gospel, read parts of the gospel. What I do every year at Christmas is I read from Matthew the Sermon on the Mount. I always find it very moving. I always find it very inspiring. And I always find it that it increases my attachment to Krishna, and it increases my attachment to Srila Prabhupada, and increases my desire to perform bhakti. So I highly recommend reading something today from the life of Jesus that one finds inspiring.
Mataji, can I just ask one quick question while you're talking about Jesus?
Very quick.
You mentioned many times that, just really quick, but sorry, the saint of Avila, sorry, just forgot, Teresa of Avila.
Teresa of Avila.
I understood that she was speaking about a conjugal relationship, but in regards to Jesus.
Well, you have to remember that her realization is going to be discussed through the terminology of her particular time and place. So, I mean, it was reading her book on interior mansions, which was recommended to me by Janavi, now Janavi Jivani Harrison, Kripa Moyes, and Guru Charanapadma's daughter. She was one who recommended that book to me, and it was one of those real life-changing books in the sense that I got a different perspective on doctrine and ritual, beliefs and practices, than I had before. So Teresa of Avila was speaking through the terminology of her religion. I mean, she writes that God is much more than is explained by our priests and mentors. You know, to really see God is something far beyond what we're being taught, what we're understanding. But I think that's even true for us. You know, we have these things from our acharyas and the shastras that when the devotee actually sees God, I mean, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, when one sees God, one says, oh, comparing your eyes to lotuses was an offense. You can't be compared to anything. You're beyond anything. So I think such a situation also exists to a much lesser extent because we're given far more information. But, you know, she's conflating Jesus with God. And in one sense, that's a fact. You know, in one sense, it's a fact. So it's not that she was exactly becoming the bride of Christ in a, you know, one could take that to mean something really awful and disgusting. Like, you know, these false gurus who have some illicit affairs with their disciples. So it's not, that's not what's going on. She's seeing in a transcendent way. I mean, Srila Prabhupada talks about how the guru is one. We say, Sakshat Haritvena. And there is a sense in which God and guru are one. You know, these are the kind of things that if you got to be really careful how you speak about them, because they can be so easily misunderstood and misapplied. And they have been misunderstood and misapplied even in our Hare Krishna movement, and they will be misunderstood and misapplied till the end of time. But, you know, Rupa Goswami writes that the way of worshipping God can also be applied to worshipping guru. Now, we don't worship guru as, you know, in the rasas like that. Guru is our strictly teacher and parent. There's no question even of worshipping guru as friend in the ordinary sense, in the kind of sense like a buddy. You know, you can worship Krishna like a buddy. You can say to Krishna, hey, you know, you didn't lift Govardhan Hill, it was actually Madhu Mangal's mantras that did it, and I'm going to defeat you in wrestling. You know, you can worship Krishna like that. You can worship Krishna as a child. You know, naughty, naughty, naughty Krishna, naughty God. You know, you can worship God like that, as your equal or as your inferior. And you certainly never treat guru like that. There's no question. Or to speak of conjugal. But there is a sense in which there's a oneness, and we accept that as well. We accept that for the pure devotee, there is a oneness. And what exactly that means, that's, as they say, beyond my pay grade. So one can, we can talk about that, we can describe it, because it's there in our own literature, but it's not, I think it's something that we have to just simply offer our obeisances to. But everyone speaks within the language of their tradition, and trying to interpret that language from another tradition may be somewhat problematic. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.